From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. I'm Eric Westervelt. On this episode, a look at the brutal back-office operations of the so-called Islamic State.
It's sophisticated and it's professional, and it's kind of scary.
And we talked to Wellesley graduate Alex Poon about his experience as a trans man on campus.
When people say, you know, like, you don't belong, it's a women's college, it was intended for women. You're right, it's a difficult position to be put in.
Also, are some Liberians getting lax about Ebola? Plus, the full story of World War II's codebreaker, Alan Turing.
As a filmmaker, it's such a blessing because you find the story that you just need to tell.
Those stories and more on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. The Sunni extremist group that calls itself the Islamic State has captured huge parts of Iraq and Syria with sheer brutality. ISIS likes to present itself as a descendant of a 7th century caliphate, but captured documents show that its business and management structure is modern and sophisticated, more like a multinational corporation than an ancient religious dynasty. Cam Simpson is an investigative reporter with Bloomberg Businessweek. He says much of what we know about ISIS's structure comes from documents found in a ditch in Anbar province by U.S. Marines on a routine patrol during the surge and from a hard drive captured not long after that.
You know, in 2007, as the surge was getting going in Iraq, there was a group that called itself the Islamic State of Iraq, and it's the same group. But it was structured like what they call, in the business world, an M-form hierarchy. And that's the kind of management model that was really pioneered by Alfred Sloan of General Motors in the 1920s. It's considered by a lot of management experts as the most revolutionary change in organizational structure in history. But what it means, basically, is you've got senior leaders who don't do daily decision-making. They focus on strategy. They focus on overall performance. They monitor performance. But the group is set up so it's semi-autonomous in every way, sort of across its entire field of operations. So the decisions of how things run on a day-to-day basis are being made by people at the local level.
Well, wait a minute. This is kind of deeply twisted. You're saying that the group's sort of manager, so to speak, are measuring performance, but in this case, it's based on suffering, death, and destruction.
I know. It's really disturbing. And like a corporation, and unfortunately, it's not a conceit, they take an extraordinary amount of big data that they collect to measure performance on a day-to-day basis. But you, like you say, unfortunately for the world, that performance is death. Every year, they publish an annual report. It's 410 pages, and it's full of these macabre metrics of assassinations, armed attacks, bombings, house bombings, prisoners freed, suicide vest bombings, suicide car bombings, and they're broken down across all their regions of operation. I mean, it's the kind of tool that you would see somebody who runs a company would be able to look at and say, my operations in southern Baghdad are suffering for this specific kind of thing that I'm interested in, and I need to change it this way. And it's sophisticated and it's professional, and it's kind of scary.
Cam, these metrics are largely self-generated. I mean, who's to say they're not just part of ISIS's pretty sophisticated propaganda machine?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Eric. I mean, some researchers at the West Point Counterterrorism Center asked exactly that question before this group was on anybody's radar screen. They were looking at these numbers. And what they did was they took a subset that they could test kind of independently with press accounts and what they were hearing from the government of Iraq. And that was about 200 attacks in Baghdad. And they found that they were sadly extremely accurate just from the sort of independent open source public reporting that was out there.
Cam, it's been said that ISIS is one of the best-funded terrorist organizations in history. What do these documents that Marines stumbled upon in the hard drive they later captured tell us about how they raise revenue?
What the documents in 2007 showed about how the group was originally structured was that all of these individual units across the Anbar province were self-financing. They have an entire division called the Spoils Division, and they go after plunder of their murdered, vanquished enemies. You know, they seize their property and they sell it. They control smuggling routes. They extort taxes the way the mafia used to do in every area that they control. You know, before they even took over Mosul and really woke up the world this past summer, the State Department estimated they were getting $12 million a month in revenue from running these extortion and smuggling rackets out of Mosul. In addition to that, you know, they have oil wells. The U.S. has been degrading its capacity to make money off of oil, but it's just hard to imagine that they're going to be able to put much of a dent overall in the financing of the organization. They just have too much money already.
More than 2 months into U.S. airstrikes against ISIS, the group has only expanded its reach and entrenched its position in key places like Mosul. Is its decentralized structure making it a lot harder to defeat this group and to try to degrade it?
When you have individual nodes that are self-sufficient across this massive swath of territory that they control, just knocking out the top would be a setback, and it would probably be a significant setback. But those individual nodes would keep running because they're self-sufficient, they're self-financing. We see it across the board. You know, no person holding money holds money for more than a couple weeks at a time. So if you have people who are making all these individual decisions and actually running the group day-to-day on the ground who are separate from the central leaders, just attacking the central leaders is really difficult. And I think that seeing the organization this way and understanding its management model also led me to understand why, as you said, it's been so difficult to try and turn them back or to even stop their progress.
It's going to take a lot more than airstrikes. You have to put local pressure and really go after the larger structure that's pretty entrenched.
Absolutely. There has to be consistent, sustained local pressure on every one of those local nodes across two countries. Right now, we know, I think at this moment, and it's always changing, unfortunately, because you said they're always expanding, but they have 18 different regional operations, and then there are sub-operations underneath each one of those. And you really have to bring that local pressure to bear, as the U.S. did during the surge in Iraq starting in 2007 and the Sunni awakening, you know, where we bought these tribal, Sunni tribal leaders and brought them onto our side and had them also go after Islamic State of Iraq at the same time. And even then, it was just such a hard-fought campaign. It's really hard to see how the Iraqi army, even with tremendous support from the air from the U.S. and other allies in the region, is going to do much damage.
Cam Simpson is an investigative correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek. His piece, The Banality of Islamic State, How ISIS Corporatized Terror, is out now. Cam, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks so much, Eric. It's been a pleasure.
In Liberia, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf says she's hoping for no new Ebola cases by Christmas. The number of new cases in Liberia is going down, but many health officials say the president's goal is just too optimistic. Schools are set to be closed until March, but a national Senate election, which was postponed once, is now set for mid-December. That means campaigning, which means crowds. NPR's Kelly McEvers sent this report from a rally in Liberia's capital, Monrovia.
Back in August and September, when 100 people were getting Ebola a day, Monrovia was a ghost town. Ebola treatment units were full, regular hospitals were closed, people were dying in the streets, and a lot of people stayed home. Now, hundreds of people are heading out to big campaign rallies. For the first time in a long time, there's a reason to party in Monrovia. The first people we meet are hanging back. They say they're trying to follow the rules in the time of Ebola. Keep your distance, no touching. I ask Ophelia Gaga if her family talks about Ebola. She says it's all they talk about, especially how and when to wash your hands in chlorinated water. It kills Ebola.
In the Bible, you wash your hands. Before eating, you wash your hands. Everything concerning me, I wash my hands day and night.
Day and night, before you go to the bathroom, before you eat. Ophelia says she's sick of washing hands. She's just happy to relax.
So you say better to not worry.
Yes.
And relax. And
relax.
Dance.
And then dance.
Muna Kra is dancing too.
So why did you come today?
To jubilate
Muna is a member of the opposition party, which is sponsoring the event.
Do you think about it? Are you scared about Ebola?
I'm not afraid of Ebola.
Why not?
Because I know I'm protected by God. So even if I wash my hands, I know that I'm protected by God.
She knows she is protected by God.
How do you know?
I know. I'm a child of God. I'm a Christian. I believe in faith. I believe that my faith will make me to be protected from Ebola.
Really?
Yes.
So even if you didn't wash your hands, God would protect you?
God would protect me. But actually, I'm going by it.
Right.
I'm still washing
You're
my
doing
hands.
Both. You have both.
Yeah.
You have hands, mm-hmm. washing, and God. That's good.
So that's what the ladies on the periphery have to say. But if you look deeper into the crowd, you see people flirting, hugging, touching. And we start to hear a lot of different theories about Ebola. Some people say Ebola doesn't exist at all. Marcy Taylor comes out to tell me and our interpreter her theory.
If the leader of Liberia knew that Ebola was here in this country, I believe that they were never going to have election into Liberia.
So she believed that Ebola is over and gone. Because if there was still Ebola,
they wouldn't have elections.
Wouldn't have elections.
Right.
Turns out a lot of people think this. The government closed schools and markets and said no public gatherings. But now they're allowing public gatherings for elections. So they say that must mean Ebola is gone. We tried several times to reach a government spokesman to ask him about this, but he did not return our calls. One thing we do know is that postponing the election any further would go against the Constitution. Journalists here say no party would want to be criticized for doing that. Walter Cole just graduated high school. He says he follows the news that Ebola treatment units, or ETUs, are still being built around Liberia.
My opinion is that I still believe that Ebola is still in Liberia. Because if there was no Ebola in Liberia, they would not be building ETUs all around town. So those that are saying that Ebola is not here is that because they are not monitoring news day and night. That's why they are saying Ebola is not here.
Walter says he had hoped to go to trade school this fall. But now he's just sitting at home, waiting for schools to open again. Before that happens, the election parties are getting bigger every day. Kelly McEvers, NPR News, Monrovia.
Women's colleges in America are grappling with if and how they might change admissions policies to welcome transgender students. Some colleges, including Mount Holyoke, have formally changed policies to accept students who identify as a gender other than that assigned at birth. Mount Holyoke leaders say concepts of what it means to be a woman are not static. Other schools, like Wellesley College, say applicants to the school must identify themselves as women. But it's not that simple. Meet Alex Poon. He was born female but identifies now as male. Alex graduated from Wellesley this past summer. I asked him what his experience was like there.
In my opinion, I feel that, you know, Wellesley has a zero tolerance policy for transphobia, you know, which makes Wellesley such a unique and special place and really a safe place for trans students like me who are just, you know, there to learn and don't want to have their gender identity kind of thrown into the mix. And there was this contest at the end of your senior year, and it's called hoop rolling. The story goes that the winner of the hoop rolling race is supposed to be very successful in the future. And when I won hoop rolling, my friends and students who were in my class carried me on their shoulders. And it was just so nice to feel so accepted by all my peers around me.
Alex, you were accepted by your fellow students, by your family. But when you went to the administration, do you feel your concerns were heard?
In general, I'd say yes. I think something that's really been pushed in the past couple of years at Wellesley with the administration is changing the signage on the bathrooms. You know, inherently, just looking at the ratio of male-bodied people and female-bodied people at Wellesley, there are many more female-bodied people. So it makes sense that there are more female bathrooms. and, you know, trans students, students like me, want to use the bathroom that says men on it, not the bathroom that says women or female on it with like the little girl in the dress. And so a lot of students pushed to have the signage changed on some of the single stall bathrooms and a lot of the academic buildings and even in the residential buildings, you know, to say all gender bathroom or just bathroom. You know, it doesn't need to be gender specific to be more inclusive.
Would you like to see the college
clarify and take a more firm position on the issue?
I think that would be good, maybe to at least put a statement out about trans people. I think it's difficult when not a lot of announcements have been made about Wellesley's policy. I think that can cause a lot of rumors, a lot of confusion, a lot of anxiety.
Alex, my grandmother went to Wellesley and she graduated in the 30s, and I know she cared deeply that this was a women's only college. And I think she might say, if she were alive today, I don't get this. What do you say to people that sort of say, you know, I hear you, but I don't understand it?
I definitely understand that perspective, and I think that perspective is important to hear to current students, especially the ones in my generation. When people say, you know, like, you don't belong, it's a women's only place. It's a women's college. It was intended for women. This is a women's only school. You're right, it's a difficult position to be put in. On one hand, I was born female, and I was definitely read as female, treated as female. I understand those experiences of being female. So I do have some commonalities and some common shared experiences with the majority of the Wellesley student body. However, Wellesley is really asking this question right now. What does it mean to be a woman in the 21st century? Times are definitely changing, times are definitely shifting, but Wellesley's core values, I feel like, have not changed.
Alex Boone, thanks for coming on the show.
Of course, thanks for having me.
By the way, we contacted Wellesley College, and in a statement, they said they're talking with staff, faculty, and students to explore the issue of gender fluidity with thoughtfulness and deliberation. You've heard about criminals hiding payment card skimmers in gas pumps to steal your credit card numbers, right? Well, this isn't your classic case of identity theft. Instead of going on shopping sprees or buying flat-screen TVs, organized crime gangs are now outbuying gallons of diesel fuel. NPR's Daniel Hajek has our story.
At the Glendale Police Department just north of Los Angeles, Sergeant Dan Suttles sees this kind of thing all the time.
Every one of those are re-encoded.
He's in the evidence room opening an envelope full of gift cards, hotel key cards, blank cards with magnetic strips.
These are the types of things that we're finding at, when we do these search warrants and we're going to their houses, just stacks of cards.
All stored with stolen credit card numbers from card skimming devices, secretly installed in gas pumps across the country. But here's what's different. Thieves use these cards at gas stations to buy fuel, usually diesel, which is then sold on the black market. So who's buying it? Well, truckers, taxi companies, and construction crews, anyone looking for cheap gas.
They're going to drive through and go, hey, I got some fuel. You either go across the street and you pay a dollar extra a gallon for it, or you buy it from this guy for a dollar off.
Suttles says L.A. is a hotspot, but thieves in Atlanta, parts of Florida, and Oregon are doing the same thing, selling stolen diesel by the truckload. U.S. Secret Service agent Steve Scarence is walking through an impound lot in Compton.
Most of our cases will take anywhere from 5 to 10 trucks. That's a typical size crew that operates here in Los Angeles.
The Secret Service investigates financial fraud. Scarence's department is tasked with investigating these crimes. He says gas thieves use utility vans and trucks with hidden tanks called bladders that hold the fuel, like this white Dodge Ram pickup truck they seized earlier this year. Scarron says this group made runs between Vegas and L.A. Underneath the truck bed's hardcover is a homemade rig of tubes and a welded-together 250-gallon aluminum tank.
When they first get these trucks, the first thing they do is they actually pull out the gas tank and they punch holes into it. They just plumb in all the different pipes that they need to draw the fuel into this larger tank in the back.
He opens the driver's side door and points to a hidden switch on the dashboard.
This red switch is what activates the siphoning pump.
Flip the switch, and a pump in the back of the truck kicks on. This is how the fuel moves from the gas tank up into the bladder. Don't be fooled by these beat-up trucks and makeshift rigs. Scarron says this is a lucrative enterprise.
Our average case is between $5 and $10 million gross profit per year if we just left them alone to do what they were doing.
Some crews even invest in tanker trucks. There's one parked in the back of the lot. He says these thieves were stealing 4,000 gallons of diesel a day.
Our big fear, of course, is when one of these goes ignites, that's when there'll be a lot of carnage.
Those jerry-rigged pipes, pumps, and gas tanks leak. Here in L.A., a man lit a cigarette while he was stealing fuel a couple years back, and his truck exploded. Back at the Glendale Police Department, Sergeant Dan Suttles says that doesn't deter the thieves.
I actually interviewed one of these guys, and I asked him, I said, why do you do this? Because it's not right. And he says, well, I've opened up two legitimate businesses. I have a house that's clear and paid for. I have put my daughter through USC. You tell me why I wouldn't do this.
The risk is low. Diesel is an untraceable commodity. But getting caught is a different story. A man in Texas and two men in Hawaii were sentenced to 20 years for installing skimming devices in gas pumps. In Idaho, a suspect faces a federal case. Meanwhile, here in California, Suttle says re-encoding credit cards is a misdemeanor. In his view, that's too lenient.
Literally just a slap on the wrist.
The reward, Suttle says, is too high. Thieves will keep filling up their tanks. Daniel Hajek, NPR News.
One of the great voices in jazz was introduced with a whisper.
You are my sunshine.
This is how many fans discovered Sheila Jordan as a guest singer on pianist George Russell's 1962 arrangement of You Are My Sunshine. Since then, Jordan's career has taken her all over the world. And in 2012, she received one of the highest honors in jazz. She became a National Endowment for the Arts Jazz Master. A new biography called Jazz Child, A Portrait of Sheila Jordan, tells her story, from discovering and befriending Charlie Parker to the racism she faced as a white woman hanging out with black musicians, all the way back to growing up dirt poor in Pennsylvania coal country, raised by alcoholic grandparents.
I was very unhappy as a little kid, and the way I got rid of that unhappiness was to sing, so I was constantly singing. And then I moved back to Detroit when I was 14 to live with my mother, and that's where I got turned on to jazz. I went down to this hamburger place that had a jukebox, and I was always playing the music on that, and one day I saw, said, Charlie Parker and his Reboppers, now's the time.
One night in Detroit, not long after you discovered Charlie Parker on the jukebox, you tried to get into a local club to hear Parker and his band. You were 14. Can you tell us about that night?
Bird was playing at a club called the Club Elsino, and you had to be 21 years old to get in there. So I said, oh, I've got to hear my hero. And I forged my mother's birth certificate, and I dyed my hair blonde, and I wore a hat with a veil and high-heeled shoes, and I was smoking a Lucky Strike cigarette, unfiltered, and I was sure I was going to get in the door smoking my cigarette and going through the whole trip. And I got to the door, and the man said, no, 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 you can't come in here. Hey, you better go home and do your homework, little white girl. And I was so disappointed. And then I went around in the alley and sat on the garbage cans. Now, Bird was by the door, so he heard all of this. He went to the back door of that club, and he stood there at one point and played. The door was open, and I sat on the garbage cans, and Charlie Parker played for me. And it was incredible.
When you wanted to go to predominantly African-American jazz clubs, you'd sometimes get harassed for hanging out with black folks?
Oh, yes. I mean, I came to New York thinking it would be so much different here. And I remember I was going out with these two painters, two guys, and they were black. And we went out to get something to eat. And on our way back, four white guys on the corner in the bar, just before we got to the front of my building, jumped us. And three of them held my two friends, and the other one threw me down on the street, was kicking my face, knocked out my tooth, and all of a sudden I looked up, and here I see a guy coming with a gun pointed, I thought, at me. I said, you know what? I'm going to die over this, but it's okay. I know I'm right. I know this is wrong. The guy was a plainclothesman. He saved my life.
Can I turn to? Where can I go? How can I face it alone?
I'm speaking with jazz singer Sheila Jordan. The new biography of her life is called Jazz Child. Sheila, your debut album, 1962's Portrait of Sheila, was critically acclaimed. I mean, by most accounts, it was a big triumph, but you didn't record then your own album again for another 12 years. Tell us what happened.
Why I never did anything after that, I don't know. I wait for people to call me. I'm kind of shy, and I just could not call up and ask them, could I do another recording? I couldn't do it.
Even if your
shy.
First recording was so well received, you just didn't feel like you had the confidence?
I don't know. I was kind of surprised. Why do they think it's so wonderful? I don't. I don't know.
You don't like to listen to your own
music? No. I don't like to listen to my own music, and I don't like to record.
So you prefer live performance with, you know, minimal backing, a bass often, just you and a bass player?
Oh, yes. I started the bass and voice in the very early 50s. You ain't been blue. No. You ain't been blue. Till you've had that mood indigo. I don't know. I just love the sound of the bass, and it was, you know, just touched a certain part of me. Oh, I loved all that, you know, space. And I remember I was visiting family in Toledo, and my half sister, I said, "Hey, you want to go and hear some music? Charlie Mingus is playing at this club." And she said, "Yeah, let's go." So we sat at a table, and Mingus saw me, and he was shocked. He said, "Whoa, what are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I'm visiting family." So then he was like, "Okay, come on up and sing something with me." I said, "What?" He said, "Come up and sing." "Oh, no." And my sister, go sing. So I'd never sung out with the bass and voice before, and I did, and I sang Yesterdays.
Days I knew, and happy, sweet, sequester days.
Sheila, you're an innovator and an icon, but you're hardly a household name. I mean, does that ever bother you?
No, I don't care. The people that, you know, respect what I do and hire me, that's all I need, you know. I just need to keep doing this music as long as I live. And in your 80s, to be able to still perform this music and get on an airplane and go all over the world, which I've done in the last couple of months. I was on a tour of Norway and on a tour of I just got off of a tour of Germany. So I'm doing okay.
You're 86 and you're still going full steam ahead, Sheila. It's amazing.
Yes.
That's singer Sheila Jordan. There's a new biography out by Ellen Johnson called Jazz Child, A Portrait of Sheila Jordan. Miss Jordan, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, it was such a pleasure to talk to you.
Was mine. Joyous, free, and flaming life pursues was mine. Glad am I, sad am I, for today.
Pope Francis was in Turkey today on a state visit. He called for religious tolerance between Christians and Muslims at a violent time in the Middle East. Just over the border in Iraq and Syria, the so-called Islamic State has been slaughtering Shiite Muslims, as well as Christians and other groups they deem heretical. People are watching Francis's visit closely, in part because the Pope has a tendency to surprise people. His comments about gays, abortion, and non-believers have made headlines, and he's made fighting poverty a central focus of his papacy. Austin Ivory is the author of a new biography, The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. The book examines Francis's upbringing in Argentina, his Jesuit background, and how that influences the way he runs the church and leads the world's 1.2 billion Catholics. Ivory says Francis has already drawn a clear contrast with his predecessors.
The difference between him, I think, and other popes is that he frequently stops and makes the person that he's talking to the protagonist. So suddenly the focus really is on ordinary people, the people that he's talking to. And I draw the contrast between that and say Pope Benedict was very shy, so he would withdraw from people. John Paul II, of course, was like a great emperor. He could hold great crowds in thrall. So I think this is a new style of Pope, a new way of being Pope among the people, and that is, as it were, to make the ordinary people the protagonist.
And not just among the people. I mean, you suggest he's got a new way of sort of walking the talk about the dispossessed, perhaps in a way recent popes have not.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's the first pope to come, of course, from the New World. He's the first pope really to come out of that context where poverty is dominant. Now, that's a very different kind of context from which popes have traditionally come. That gives him a sensitivity to poverty. It gives him a sensitivity to need and to vulnerability. And from the very beginning, therefore, he's identified with and used the language of what he calls the existential margins, the existential peripheries, as he calls them. Now, existential peripheries is obviously a places of pain and suffering, but it also has a kind of concrete sense in Latin America as being the shanty towns that encircle the cities. So this is the place he wants the church to be seen in, to identify with, to speak from, to evangelize from. That's what also makes him a radical in that Latin American liberation theology tradition.
His time in Argentina was not without controversy. He's been accused by some human rights activists for complicity in the Argentine dictatorship and the so-called dirty war of the 70s and early 80s. Francis tried to shelter Jesuits, but the left attacked him for not speaking out. Why didn't he speak out more?
Well, he didn't speak out because speaking out would have contradicted his two objectives during the Dirty War, which were objectives, in fact, given him from Rome. One was to protect the Jesuits from the regime, and the second was that he should help the victims of the dictatorship. And, of course, he couldn't fulfil either of those objectives if he took a position of opposition to the regime, which, anyway, wouldn't have resulted in anything, because anybody who did speak out against the regime was quickly silenced or exiled. So those were his two objectives, and he pulled it off to a remarkable extent. Not one Jesuit lost his life, and he did protect, we now know, and sheltered dozens of people who were fleeing the dictatorship.
I'm speaking with Austin Ivory. His new book is The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. He's made some comments that seem to bolster liberals. He said Jesus, you know, had redeemed everyone, including atheists. He said the church spends too much time talking about abortion and gay marriage. But you write that his comments should not be misinterpreted as, you know, doctrinal flexibility.
I feel very strongly that he's been consistently misjudged by one group of Catholics and also, of course, by certain parts of the liberal media, which are trying to paint him. They know he's shaking things up, which he is. But they mistake that for a kind of attempt to change doctrine. I mean, on all the core Catholic teachings, he is a absolutely straight down the line Orthodox Catholic. But he is also an evangelizer and a missionary. And his observation, the famous observation that we shouldn't bang on too much about abortion and those other issues, his point is not that abortion isn't wrong. I can cite you many speeches in which he gives searing denunciations of abortion. It's that he says it is not enough for people to look at the Catholic Church and say, yes, that's what the church stands for. What's missing from the picture, he says, is the merciful face of Christ, the church that heals the wounds, that raises people up, that nurtures them, that forgives them. And so what he's trying to do is to say, actually, that's the face of the church that needs to be presented. Now, this isn't a PR exercise. What he's actually saying is that people need to experience that before they are ready to accept the rest of it. So what is conversion? Conversion is when somebody first experiences the love and mercy and forgiveness of God, and then having assimilated that, then, as it were, chooses the Christian life, chooses the moral life, and so on. But you can't go to the second without the first.
Austin, in both tone and title, you call Francis a radical reformer, but he's only been pope for a little over a year. Isn't that a bit premature? What has he really reformed in terms of the way the Vatican and worldwide Catholicism are run?
I'm very confident that history will judge Pope Francis to be one of the great church reformers, even if his papacy comes to a close within the next couple of years for reasons of age or infirmity. And I'm convinced of that because he has already done and said enough to have turned round so many things in the church. And he's put in train reforms of governance which I think are irreversible and which are at the moment transforming the church and will actually transform the church for many years to come. So I'm convinced actually that the next papacies will be papacies that actually implement the reforms that he has begun.
That's Austin Ivory. His new book is The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. Austin, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
The new film, The Imitation Game, tells the story of World War II codebreaker Alan Turing. Benedict Cumberbatch plays the socially awkward, eccentric British mathematician who led the effort to break the Nazis' secret codes.
I like solving problems, Commander. And Enigma is the most difficult problem in the world.
No, Enigma isn't difficult, it's impossible. The Americans, the Russians, the French, the Germans, everyone thinks Enigma is unbreakable.
Good. Let me try, and we'll know for sure, won't we?
Turing went on to crack the Nazis' Enigma machine, and his work was instrumental in helping bring World War II to a close faster. The Imitation Game chronicles Alan Turing's work as a codebreaker, the bullying he faced in his youth, and the trials he endured as a gay man in Britain at a time when homosexuality was a crime. The film's director, Morton Tilden, spoke with NPR's Arun Roth.
So first, I'm curious, what did you know about Alan Turing before you started on this project?
First of all, I didn't know anything about Alan Turing. I was shocked how little I knew. I mean, why wasn't this man on the front cover of my history book when I was at school? Because his achievements are so staggering. So I became obsessed with him. I needed to know everything. And as a filmmaker, it's such a blessing because you find the story that you just need to tell. And you feel you're part of something which become very important.
And well, there's a reason why we don't know as much about him or why for so long we didn't, because all of that work, the code-breaking work, was top secret.
Yeah, everything was burnt, everything was erased. It was kept secret for almost 50 years. Probably one of the, you know, best-kept secrets ever. So many people never spoke to. Now, they didn't tell their husbands, they didn't tell their children. And also Alan Turing, who stood trial. You know, he was
charged with indecency because he was homosexual.
For being a gay man after the war in the UK, which is in itself is shocking. But standing trial, he never spoke. He never raised his hand and said, "Do you know what I did? I was a war hero. I saved millions of people." Yeah. He never said anything. And it's just staggering to think about.
So you trace the secrets of Alan Turing's life. But you pull off something kind of tricky because you jump around from different periods, his youth at a British public school, his time doing the code-breaking work in World War II, and then that time later in his life. Why that approach? Why not just take things in order?
I mean, first of all, I didn't want it to be told as a traditional history lesson. I wanted the movie to be intriguing, thrilling, exciting, and because that's how his life was. To me, Alan Turing was a mystery. It was sort of like something I needed to unravel. And he was also obsessed with puzzles. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make the movie like a mystery, like a puzzle that you're piecing together.
Benedict Cumberbatch does amazing acting without words, with his body and his eyes conveying Turing's awkwardness.
I mean, Benedict transforms. He doesn't act. I mean, he becomes Turing. I put aside 3 weeks of rehearsal, which is now getting rarer and rarer to actually have that. And we were able to really explore these characters and really find the voice of Alan Turing and try to create him, because there's no recordings of him. Nobody knows how he talks. Nobody knows how he moves. There's only, you know, just descriptions of him. So we had to sort of like piece him together.
Alan?
Yes?
I said we're going to get some lunch. Alan?
Yes?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I said we're off to get some lunch. This is starting to get a little bit repetitive.
What is?
I had asked if you wanted to come to lunch with us.
No, you didn't. You said you were going to get some lunch.
I really think he makes Alan Turing come to life. And Alan Turing's family was there on the when we opened the British Film Festival. They were very complimentary about how we did. So that was a good feeling.
And there are artistic liberties taken, something that you have to do in the course of making a dramatic film. Were you nervous about any of that, given the fact that a lot of people have invested a lot into Alan Turing?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest artistic license we did was actually to compress things.
Mm-hmm.
The thing, though, is that the story of Alan Turing is so, I mean, if you wrote it as fiction, You would go like, this could never happen. This is too wild. You have this awkward mathematician that becomes this super spy and, you know, cracks the Nazi Enigma code and is gay and is being prosecuted for it. And it's like...
And fathers computer science.
And yeah, not to mention he actually creates computer science. But it's all true. So it's more been a choice of what to tell and not what not to tell.
You know, there have been other dramatic adaptations of Turing's life. What was the story that you wanted to tell?
To me, it's the story about the outsider. To me, I wanted to make a celebration about being different. And also how important it is to actually celebrate those who are different than us instead of fear them.
Morten Tildum is the director of The Imitation Game, the new film that tells the story of Alan Turing. Morten, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Eric Westervelt.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train.
Janis Joplin once said, on stage I make love to 25,000 different people, then I go home alone. That gives us a glimpse of the outsider isolation she felt throughout her life. But she wasn't alone. She had John Byrne Cook. Cook was Janis Joplin's first and only road manager from 1967 until her death due to a heroin overdose in 1970. Cook was the one who found her body. His new memoir is On the Road with Janis Joplin. In 67, Cook was fresh out of Harvard when legendary rock manager Albert Grossman asked him to fly out to San Francisco to help manage this up-and-coming singer with a whiskey-sweet voice and her psychedelic blues rock band Big Brother and The Holding Company.
I had been there a few months earlier with the D.A. Pennybaker film crew at the Monterey Pop Festival in June, and over the years I had visited the Bay Area quite a lot.
John, did you know anything about actually managing a rock band when you took this job?
No, I didn't. And, you know, there was no pool of qualified candidates at that point. And when Albert Grossman started managing Dylan, and when he came up to Cambridge, Mass., where I was playing bluegrass and old-time music, and he had a road manager with him in the spring of 64, we thought, far out. You know, here's this guy who drives the Ford station wagon. He makes sure there's some bottles of Beaujolais wine in there. Dylan doesn't have to do anything but get on stage and play. And so Albert was looking for somebody who could do the job but didn't know he could do the job.
You mentioned you were part of D.A. Pennybaker's film crew that documented Monterey Pop. It's at that concert that Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin become almost overnight sensations. Your book makes clear that as her music and fame started to grow, she sort of outgrows her first band, Big Brother. Then you were with her when she forms her new group, Cosmic Blues Band, tours Europe, performs at Woodstock. You were her one and only road manager. I mean, she switched bands, she switched boyfriends, but she stuck with you.
Janis's progression from one band to the next was really the dramatic arc of the 3 years that I was with her. And many people may think that her last act was her most difficult, but you just mentioned the Cosmic Blues Band, Eric. She left Big Brother, whom she loved, because she saw a greater challenge, which was, could she hold center stage and the spotlight alone as a solo artist with a backup band? And in that year, she felt that she was failing. And when she and Albert Grossman decided to terminate the Cosmic Blues Band after the contracted gigs were played, she felt that she was a failure, that her attempt to go out as a solo artist had failed. And this led to her darkest period and the worst excesses in terms of alcohol and drugs.
You, babe.
You recount some poignant scenes near the end of the book where Janice goes to her 10th high school reunion in her hometown of Port Arthur, Texas. You know, she didn't have a happy high school experience. She was the outsider, the loner, and some people made fun of her. Now she's back. She wants to kind of take her revenge, but it's hardly a triumphant return. Tell us about that.
People, rather than flocking to her, seem to be sort of hypersensitive about not flocking to her. The only three guys that I remember that kind of clustered around her and came with us when we went out to go have a drink, my interpretation was they were exactly the guys who were not particularly nice to her in high school and who now were fawning over her a little bit because she was famous. But I think maybe she expected more attention. It's hard to say.
Then you guys end up at a rowdy Texas roadhouse drinking hard where Jerry Lee Lewis is playing a live show, and it's sort of tequila and fisticuffs follow.
Janice had seen Jerry Lee Lewis earlier in the summer, and she eyed this pretty young guy who was in Jerry Lee's band and I think turned out to be his son, actually. And then when we found out that Jerry Lee was playing at a Texas roadhouse in Beaumont, not far from Port Arthur, you know, that was really her target. She wanted to go see that kid again. And we went backstage, and Jerry Lee was definitely not welcoming. I mean, she said, "Hi, Jerry Lee, this is my hometown. I wanted to, you know, make you welcome here." But he made a remark about Janice's sister. Anyway, she flew at him, and we pulled her off and kept them apart, and we got her out of there. It was a very country rock and roll evening.
Finally, it's October 1970, John, and you're in L.A. with the band, deep into recording what would be her final album, Pearl, with her new band, Full Tilt Boogie. And one afternoon, you know, she doesn't show up for the recording session, and you're the one who heads out to try to find her, and you start at the hotel. Can you read that for us?
As I pass through the lobby, I stop at the desk and get a key to Janice's room from Jack Hagee, the manager. I can't say just why I get the key now. I think Janice is in her room, so why do I need it? Well, what if she's in the shower? Some such idea may pass through my head, but mostly I'm saving time. If I knock and she doesn't answer, I'll have to come back for the key. When I open the door to room 105, there's no one there. That's the feeling I have, even as I see Janice lying on the floor beside the bed. Before I touch the unnatural flesh, I know that this is only the vessel. The spirit has departed.
John, a lot has been written about Janice Joplin. What don't we know about her and her personality that comes out in your book?
What people know is the dynamic personality on stage, and then in addition to that, the kind of brash woman of the streets, which was part of the public personality that she projected. But, you know, she was also sweet and vulnerable and compassionate, and she could be this little girl who was so full of doubt about whether she was doing a good enough job that she could come off stage with this tumultuous ovation happening out there and saying, "Did I do okay?" But smart and funny, I think, most of all, are the parts that I would like people to know were an important part of her personality.
I'll do a song, man, and I'll tell you. It's talking about everybody's life, man, and what passes by you and what you miss and what you grab, man. It's a song called Get It While You Can, because it ain't going to be there when you wake up, man.
John Byrne Cook, his new memoir is On the Road with Janice Joplin. John, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Eric, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
In this world, if you read the papers, don't you know everybody's fighting with each other? You got no one you can count on, dear, not even your brother. So if someone comes along.
For the week ending November 30th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, Becky Sullivan, and Denise Guerra. Our intern is Chloe Prasinos. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is senior producer. I'm Eric Westervelt. We'll be back next week. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.
But who?